Hello, my name is Brian McKenna. I'm one of the editors at Computer Weekly, and I'm here to wish you a very warm welcome to the Computer Weekly
Downtown Upload
podcast.
And those two other voices there were...
I'm Caroline Donnelly, I'm a senior editor at Computer Weekly.
I'm Claire McDonald, I'm the business editor at Computer Weekly.
So today we're going to talk about a few things. We're going to talk about the war between Greenpeace and AWS. Caroline's going to lead off on that. I'm going to talk a little bit about the government's announcement this week about a whole lot of investment in AI education, higher education, specifically its graduates and postdocs and so on. We're going to have a bit of a general chinwag about AI in the UK. And Claire's going to talk about Kellogg's Cornflakes.
Yes.
Other cereals are available.
They are available. It's not necessarily cornflakes, but Pop-Tart Bites.
Oh, okay. Yeah, now I'm intrigued.
Yeah, like, I'm so on board with this.
Well, that's going to be a treat for the end of the podcast.
Yeah, it's going to make my stomach rumble, so apologies.
But let's begin with two tribes going to war.
Yeah, this is a proper bun fight, the kind of story I like. So what we have is, so Greenpeace, the environmental lobbyists, they create these reports each year that basically see them grade various technology companies based on how sustainable their data center infrastructure is. So they get good grades if, say, all their data centers run on or run a lot on renewable energy, and they get bad grades if they use a lot of fossil fuels to power their data centers. And companies can get additional brownie points and gold stars, if you like, from Greenpeace if they invest in renewable projects. So they invest in initiatives that boost the amount of wind power or solar power that's available, things like that. If they invest in carbon offsetting activities, they also get extra points, if you like, for they are, you know, transparent and in how they report how much energy they use. You know, if they're very upfront about that kind of thing.
What value do these brownie points have for the cloud operators?
It's basically, so it's like a report card, so they get told, you know, a lot of these cloud companies have made pledges that they will, oh, we're going to have all of our infrastructure powered by renewable energy by like a certain time, like by a certain cutoff date and things like that. So it kind of holds them to account. I think for IT buyers, it's quite interesting to know if you, if you're a company yourself that wants to,
if you care.
If you want to kind of be like, oh, we're a sustainable company, we're working ethically, wouldn't you want that to carry out through the rest of your IT supply chain? So your, the providers you use are, we know they use green energy as well, and that kind of thing. So
give people the facts.
Exactly. So it's kind of, you know, it's beneficial to know. And, you know, and I think anyone who's kind of scrutinising what big tech companies are up to is, you know, it's always worth looking into what they're doing.
And Greenpeace has been doing this since 2010?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, so this will probably be 9 years they've been doing it now. So each year the report is a little bit different. This year in particular, they're focusing in on an area in Virginia in the USA called Data Center Alley.
Sounds fun.
Yes. And I don't know if it needs explaining, but it's so called that because there's so many data centers there. So yeah, they're focusing particularly on this area and on the providers who have data centers there. So this year, they... So there's one provider in particular who has a very sizable presence in that area, and that is Amazon.
Yeah.
And a recurring theme of these reports every year is that Amazon does come in for a bit of a kicking from Greenpeace.
As in they talk themselves up and then are found not to be doing what they said that they would?
Sometimes it's more kind of, let's say, so the first report in 2010 kind of called out, I think from memory, that AWS wasn't being very transparent on how much energy it actually uses, it consumes to run its data centres. And then they also kind of shone light on the fact that, you know, how, you know, if they've got these huge facilities, what's powering them? And it turned out a lot of it is kind of dirty energy, fossil fuels and stuff like that. So a couple of years later, I think 2014, I don't know if it's necessarily directly related to that, Amazon became one of these companies that said, oh, we're going to run all of our infrastructure on renewable energy. But they've never given a deadline for when they're going to do it. There's this phrase Amazon always uses whenever you ask them anything about, like, oh, when are you going to build this data center in this place? Or when are you going to run your whole infrastructure on renewables? And they always say, in the fullness of time. So let's just assume, in the fullness of time, they will do that. So that's kind of...
We should start using that as an excuse for other things.
Oh yeah, like PRs, like when's that article going to appear? In the fullness of time.
Perfect.
Yeah, I know. Perfect. It's a good cover, isn't it?
See, we're learning from,
from
the industry that we cover.
So this
bad habits.
Yeah. Well, this year this year Amazon have come in for a bit of a kicking again.
Yeah.
Because they, according to Greenpeace's data, they've opened 23 data centers in this region in Virginia over the last 2 years, but they've bought no new renewable projects, energy projects to the area.
Oh.
So they're sort of saying, like, how can they be working towards this renewable energy goal if they're not balancing out the size of their data center footprint with, you know, accompanying new renewables coming online?
Yeah.
So you're kind of like, okay, that's interesting. So for that reason, they've accused Amazon of backtracking on their pledge to become a 100% renewably powered company.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, a pretty big claim.
And
Amazon haven't taken it lying down. Basically, they have responded with quite a strong statement of their own, where they have counter-accused, if you like.
So tell us about this strong statement.
Yes. So they have accused Greenpeace of, and this is a direct quote, choosing to report inaccurate data about its energy use before saying they should have checked their facts with AWS before publishing.
Wow.
So it should have been fact-checked by AWS before they went public with it.
Well, is that fact-checking? Is that cleansing?
Well, who's to say? We'll leave that up to the lawyers.
Sorry.
But no, they've also sort of made the point as well that, you know, they do a lot of good work where renewable energy is concerned. They're actively involved in lobbying at a federal and state government level in the US, lobbying and campaigns around sort of tax breaks on renewables and pushing through regulatory changes that will support the growth of renewables and stuff like that. They've also made the point that I think late last year, they have invested in 53 renewable energy projects, 6 of which are in Virginia. So they're kind of, you know, we are doing our bit. We don't know what, you know, Greenpeace, like, back off kind of thing. And you're kind of bringing this, like, okay, well, this is really interesting. And that's, you know, and then they sign off their statement. So if you want the full facts, read our sustainability website, you know, green, like, suggesting perhaps Greenpeace does not have the full facts. So Greenpeace have not taken that line down. So this is where the bond fight element comes in, and I'm sitting there as these emails are going back and
eating
your forward,
popcorn.
Like, yeah, the emails are coming into my inbox. I'm like, oh my god, it's getting heated, guys. Yeah, so it turns out Greenpeace doesn't take kindly to people accusing it of using inaccurate data. So they have issued a rebuttal of their own where they acknowledge that Amazon, yes, they have invested in renewable projects, but their issue with that is that because they're not transparent and they're not upfront about how much energy their facilities use, they say it's difficult to actually ascertain how much of a difference that makes. So it's kind of like, ooh, okay, that's interesting. And So again, as they have in previous reports, they're making this case that Amazon needs to be more transparent, it needs to be more open how much energy it uses, how much is actual renewables powering its data centres, and how much is fossil fuels as well. So we've got this, and you kind of think, well, that's interesting, these statements, but now they've followed it up with a petition. They want Amazon customer, or anyone actually, to sign this petition and put more pressure on Amazon to clean up its cloud. And use more renewables, step up it. You know, as the world's biggest cloud company, should they be, you know, using far more renewables than they are at the moment, this kind of thing. So there's that element to it. And then also there's kind of some advice later on in this report that if you're an Amazon customer and you are concerned about, you know, the amount, you know, are they using enough renewables? Are they using too much fossil fuels? And as the Greenpeace report kind of makes the link, fossil fuel use is linked to climate change and lots of other bad things that we don't really want going on in the world. So they're saying to customers, you should vote with your feet. You could go with, say, another provider, so Microsoft or Google, who they kind of, I wouldn't say they give a unanimously glowing report. You know, they've got work to improve as well, but they're doing, in Greenpeace's eyes, a better job on the renewables front.
They're cleaner.
Yes, so they're sort of making the case you could go to one of them, or you could stipulate, right, Amazon, at the moment I don't want my data hosted in Virginia. There's a lot of fossil fuel use there. So can I be hosted in one of your regions? I think California's the one given in the report.
Yeah.
Because that runs 70% on renewables. Can I have my data hosted there? and that kind of thing. So they're sort of making this case that you can either, you put more pressure on Amazon, who, as it says in the report, prides itself on being a customer-focused company, so they need to listen to their customers, and customers, in fact, they need to vote with their feet and make their thoughts on this known. And I think it's interesting, though, because you do, you know, covering green IT project, green IT news generally, you do sometimes wonder about how much of a priority is that for IT buyers, for this, you know, I want this to be sustainable. How big on the checklist of, right, these are must-haves on our IT buying
list? It's a priority for the planet.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. That's what I was going to say. It should
this
be, absolutely.
This is such an interesting story because there isn't a bigger issue that's even bigger than Brexit. Climate change
bigger than Brexit.
Yeah.
You heard it here first.
It is.
Well, it is. The whole world.
Oh, yeah, no, I completely agree.
Yeah. So like I say, it kind of brings that thing, obviously it should be a priority.
There's all the school children out last week demonstrating. And
what were they doing?
They were demonstrating about climate change.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, they all left school and Theresa May was like, oh, you should be at school. Why, you know, what about all the lesson plans that have had to be ripped up when storming around London with your placards?
Well, there won't be a world to learn.
Exactly. So and then some of their placards were amazing. And you kind of think, well, they've obviously learned a lot of school because some of the language is very colourful. So, go kids, I say.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So from the ecosystem to a metaphorical ecosystem, in the sense of the government trying to promote the UK's place in artificial intelligence and trying to develop an ecosystem for AI by supporting, putting £110 million and also getting industry to put in money as well to this new graduate education programme. Master's degrees, PhDs and also fellowships associated with the Alan Turing Institute. There's going to be some government support for that as well. Very interesting. The kind of backstory to this partly is to do with Wendy Hall and Jerome Pezenti. And they produced a report which was published in October 2017. I want to get the title of this because I did write about this at the time. It was Growing the Artificial Intelligence Industry in the UK, and the kind of the point of that report, one of the big things that they said was that unless UK government, industry and academia came together around a cohesive strategy to improve and develop us as a country for AI, then we could squander an historic opportunity.
Squander.
Because indeed, as we know, Alan Turing, one of the major figures in the development of AI originally, the UK did have a pioneering role in computer science in the 40s, 50s and 60s, established all these courses at universities like Manchester and Edinburgh and Imperial and so on, which have been producing generation after generation of graduates down to this day. That was an intellectual lead that we had thanks to people like Alan Turing and so on, but that we could almost renege on that heritage unless we had this coherent strategy that brought together the IT industry in the UK, UK higher education and the government. And this is partly, I don't think it's the only thing that's fed into this, but this is one of the products of that is the announcement this week of this investment in graduate education. And it is quite a big issue for us. I mean, there's all sorts of ways we could go with this. It seems, I mean, I've had conversations with, for example, Nigel Shadbolt, who's a very good friend and former colleague of Wendy's. He's now at one of the colleges in Oxford, but he's a mover and a shaker, founder of the Open Data Institute. And last year I had a conversation with him in which one thing he said was the postdoctoral level is quite critical. It's not just a question of these PhDs being produced, but also moving them on a bit. But the big problem there is how do you keep them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, given the attractiveness of the salaries from these IT companies based in Silicon Valley, Facebook, Google, Amazon, as we've been discussing, but also the United States itself. I had a chat with a CEO contact towards the end of last year who just, at the end of the interview, he mentioned his son, who was a maths academic, university teacher at one of the kind of Ivy League US universities. And he said, well, he's on about $60,000 a year. He could go to Apple and get an entry-level salary of $300,000 a year.
How quickly that can you retrain? Listening to this, it's very, very interesting.
But that's the sort of hike. That's the kind of scale of this. And just coming back to Nigel Shadbolt, one of the things that we talked about is maybe a way around this could be, you know, you would have your university position officially as a computer scientist teaching artificial intelligence and researching into it, whilst at the same time getting your massive salary from Facebook or Google, and then you would get the kind of cross-pollination and so on. I think that is what happens in the US. You know, you'll go into the computer science department at Stanford and half the guys there are also founder CEOs of a company in Silicon Valley.
Like visiting lecturers or something.
Visiting
professors.
And I had a chat this week with a woman called Debbie Bard, and I want to get this right. She leads the data science engagement group at the National Energy Research Scientific Computing Center at Berkeley.
Because that's not a mouthful.
she's still quite an early, I guess, an early career data scientist. She's going to be speaking at the Data Fest event that's run across Scotland. She's going to be speaking in Edinburgh at the Data Fest Data Tech conference, where she's going to be keynoting. Her first degree is from Nottingham. Her PhD is from the University of Edinburgh. And there she is over, you know, doing a fantastic job and having a wonderful time at Berkeley. And one does wonder about, I mean, are we going to put this money into educating the next generation of talent in artificial intelligence, and then we lose at least, you know, a critical mass of them? I mean, Claire, you cover skills and education quite a lot. Is that an issue?
It is a tough one, because it's not just at this level that we're losing people in the pipeline. It's all the way along. It can be really difficult to direct people into a particular specialism. So even if you've got people who show some kind of interest in technology, that doesn't necessarily mean that they want to go and be a data scientist.
Yeah.
Using myself as an example, I went and did a computer science degree and became a journalist. And one of the first things that I noticed popped up as a theme when I told people, oh yeah, I did a computer science degree, decided to be a journalist, was, but you would make so much more money if you had become a computer scientist.
Yeah.
And my answer was always, yes, but I would be very unhappy.
Same, I was. I studied biochemistry at university, and people were like, you could be making so much more money as a researcher. Like, yeah. It's like, yeah, but you know, there's the fulfillment you get from being a journalist.
One of the things that Debbie Bard over at Berkeley said to me was that it's a real challenge for them to recruit in Silicon Valley, for precisely the reason that I kind of referred to earlier, is that those data scientists can go to Facebook, Google, Amazon, and earn a lot more money as well. But I mean, she said the thing that attracts people to work there in kind of scientific computing and the data science that supports that, she's a cosmologist actually by background, is just the scientific interest of the work, and you are making a difference on a quite big scale.
And anecdotally, it encourages more women to pursue careers like that if you know that you're actually making a difference with the work that you do.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, a lot of people in general don't know about the different types of roles that you can get from different skill sets like that in technology. Yeah. So I think it's like this lack of communication, which is why it's very positive to see that with this new fund from the government, there's a lot of collaboration between industry, government, and education providers.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great thing. There's no question of that. Mm. It is a really cool thing.
So I think it's a bit of a, just going back to that in terms of stopping that brain drain, I guess. It just seems like a bit of a chicken and egg problem. Obviously, we want to be retain our heritage we have, and build, and we're investing lots of money in establishing ourselves as a sort of leader in this field. And so you think it will take time for us to create a kind of a Facebook or a Google or like companies in tech giants in this country that people can go and work for. But then, let's say they go off abroad, it's just such a complex kind of. I don't know how you even begin to solve that, because we won't be able to build a tech giant over here if everybody runs off overseas to better paid positions. And the companies that are over here, is it a case of the ones who maybe are fledgling in this field, they're probably not in a financial position to compete salary-wise as well. So it's just, I don't know, you do kind of, hearing you speak about it, you kind of think, we're out of the race before we've even begun almost. It sort of sounds a bit like, I don't know, maybe I'm being really dramatic. I'm prone to it.
No, it is all very disproportionate.
Yeah.
Where you want to focus the talent and the money, and then where the talent and the money actually is.
Mm.
I think this idea that, you can go work for one of these companies as a data scientist and earn a lot of money, but at the same time keep you a link to maybe the university that produced you in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a way of helping, but then there's the whole issue of the brain drain to America, which in a way has always been with us. I guess what we just have to hope is that people like Debbie might come back and forth, and we're divided by an ocean, but we at Computer Weekly, we're part of an American company.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe post-Brexit, our links with Silicon Valley will actually strengthen.
Maybe.
It's a possibility.
That's 2 on the Brexitometer there, in terms of how many times we've mentioned it today.
I think we're doing well, considering.
It's not bad.
Yeah.
Just passing comments.
Yeah. Considering previous weeks, it has seemed a bit like we're like Brexit cops.
Okay, so we've been talking about artificial intelligence, the cutting edge of IT, and ultimately the commercial benefit of that for companies could be considerable. But let's move on to another advanced technology being used by a company to find out stuff, and that is Kellogg's.
Yes, Claire. So Kellogg's has partnered with Accenture to use virtual reality technology in a trial about visual merchandising. So it was merchandising research to find out where best to locate their new product in a store to increase sales.
Uh-huh.
So their argument was that normally when you do product research, you would be asking people to fill in an online survey, not always necessarily in a shop situation, and then you don't get any of that extra information that you can get from making someone wear a VR headset.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, so there was eye tracking technology in these VR headsets from Qualcomm, which monitored where people's eyes were going on a virtual supermarket shelf, and whether or not that would lead to a sale. So what they found is that normally when you do this customer research without any of the technology involved, that customers tend to say that they would look for new products on higher shelves first. What they actually found out was that lower shelves are the places where if you place new products, people are more likely to see them and then increase the purchase of them.
So are they saying people lie when they have to lie? People are unreliable.
Lie
maybe
to themselves.
Yes. They can't you know, they just don't know. They don't know.
It's
as
interesting
much as the
that it's, that's such a big difference in people say, oh no, I look at the top shelf, and then no, actually analysing, you look at the bottom shelf. Like,
well,
oh,
as a short person, I'm never looking at the top shelf because I can't reach anything up there anyway.
It depends what's on the shelf. If it's the wine shelf, it's kind of like price. Oh, yeah. It's like scouring for just the lowest price.
Yeah.
But, well, ratio of alcohol to price and working out the best value that way. Yeah.
All about the units.
Yeah.
You can tell that we're glad it's Friday.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's really, really interesting. But it means we're going to probably get more those like creepy things where it's, you know, retailers can predict what we're going to buy before we even walked in the shop. And then you think, right, okay, based on my next card or whatever, I'm going to buck the trend. I'm going to throw out their data by buying something completely random. And they're like, yeah, we knew you were going to do that. And you're like, no, how?
So I'm actually waiting for that day to happen because I buy a lot of vegan food. But if I go to my parents and they say, oh, can you pick me up some chicken? And then it goes on my Nectar card. And I don't want Nectar to go,
here's your offer,
here's
for,
your
loads
offer
of chicken.
For some chicken. I'll be like, you don't know me. But then also, if they said, oh, don't worry, we won't offer you chicken coupons because we know that that was for your parents, I'd be like, oh, that's creepy, don't do that.
Yeah.
Where's the line?
But it does indicate that general thing that people often say about AI, which is that the algorithms know you better than you know yourself.
Yeah. But do they?
Hmm.
Because of the bias that's built into quite a lot of algorithms that are produced by certain groups. So they might know you, Brian, a white man. But do they know someone else? I don't have an example. Of another person.
She's just going to keep sitting here menacingly slapping us down. Then do they? Which is fine, I'm comfortable with that.
But yeah, there is that creeping people out thing.
Yeah, there is a line, there is a creepy line. And you have to ask as well whether it's of benefit to the customer or whether it's of benefit to the company.
I think it depends, isn't it? Like, a lot of these things, it's your data, you can't hand it over. You think, oh, well, I do get points or I do get discounts. Or like, say you get coupons. And I think a lot of people just put that to the back of their mind, or they don't even, doesn't even register for, I think, for a lot of people. Like, oh, so who's benefiting here? It's like, well, you are, because if they're giving you a coupon, you're going to go back and shop there, so they're going to get more of your money overall. Yeah. So, yeah, you'll get a discount, but also they get a benefit. Yeah,
they get the extra shopping.
So what changes as a result of this extra layer of information?
So where they place the product in stores when they launch it, and therefore gain more sales from it and more awareness of it.
Other retailers,
How do brands. This is completely sidelined, but how do... Is that like a monetary thing? Like, would you say, like, we're Kellogg's, we're going to pay, like, Sainsbury's, Tesco, whatever, can we have our goods on this shelf? Because everyone would be fighting for that prime position, wouldn't they?
Like, presumably. Adverts in television?
Yeah. So
I don't know if that's the case, but that would be really interesting if that were true. If you said, I only want my products to appear here.
Because then you might even think, like, oh, lesser brand. Oh, they couldn't pay for a prime position.
Premium shelf.
Yeah, I'm not going to buy those own brand cornflakes. Thank you. It's interesting.
Yeah, I'll have to do some more research into that and find out, because if that is the case, can you imagine? Mind blown.
Yes.
Visits to the supermarket will never be the same again.
Or it just be all top shelves. They just get rid of them.
There are no top shelves anymore. Everything's in buckets.
And that would be bad for you, because, like you say, you're short. So you're
Help
me, please.
Excuse me, sir.
Need to reach that. Interesting.
So next week, completely unrelatedly, is Mobile World Congress.
Yes.
Mobile World Congress.
Mm. Another visit to
Barcelona.
I know.
Another visit to Barcelona for our networking editor colleague, Alex Croxton. I think he's going to come in and talk to us, isn't he?
Give us his highlights, probably low points of
the
whole thing.
The download for the download.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, we can look forward to that next week. So in the meantime, thanks to Caroline, Claire.
Cheers.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening. Cheers. Bye-bye.